You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Frank Langella has a way of inhabiting a role so completely that you can watch an entire performance and not recognize it's him until the curtain call. His latest onstage incarnation is as Richard M. Nixon in the hit play Frost Nixon, a behind-the-scenes story of David Frost's legendary interviews with the former president 30 years ago. And I'm delighted it has given me the opportunity to speak once again with the wonderful Frank Langella. Welcome back.
Hello, Leonard. Nice to be back.
Did you pay a lot of attention to politics during the Nixon years?
No. I was in my late 20s, I guess, and an actor in working all over the country in summer theaters, and you know what you're paying attention to when you're that age. It's certainly not politics.
Well, actually, it was the 30s. I mean, you were in your 30s because it was the 70s.
You're right. I was in my 30s.
But you were still not paying attention. Were you aware of the Watergate hearings?
Oh, sure.
Did you watch the resignation speech?
They were as riveting then as O.J. was now.
Yeah. When you were sent the script, did you know immediately this was the part you wanted to play?
No, I didn't. I was actually a little afraid of it when I first read it, not necessarily for the character, but for the actual script itself, which was just words on a page. And I had a feeling it might be a rather dry evening of my standing up and then my sitting down and my walking across the stage and maybe drinking a glass of water. I wasn't prepared for the exciting thriller aspect that the director, Michael Grandage, brought to it.
And that's the way he has described it. It's also, I guess, a chess game. And I don't know if that's the same thing as a thriller, but it works that way.
Yeah.
We see the two sides working out strategies, and then we see how the game finally transpires.
It's also much more of a psychological thriller than I anticipated it would be. I am able to find a way into the heart of Nixon as a man, as a human being, as a flawed person than I thought I would be able to when I first read it.
You don't bear much of a physical resemblance to Richard Nixon. Was there a temptation to put on a prosthetic nose or to use special makeup to approximate his pasty skin tone?
No, actually, there wasn't even a thought in my head about trying to look like him. As a matter of fact, I plead guilty to the fact that I didn't want to look anything like him in the beginning, and I resisted even a wig. Mm. And then, of course, Michael convinced me that I owed it somehow visually to the audience to appear somewhat like him, if not exactly. But noses and chins and jowls never came up at all.
Well, another reason for wearing the wig, or at least looking a bit like him, is that another character in the play is the huge television screen. Mm-hmm. And we can't help but watch your face when you're on television. Watch your face on the screen and then you on the stage, the real you, and go back and forth, because that's part of what this play is also about reality and what television does to reality.
Yeah. It's so much an extraordinarily apt story about how television, as the play says, simplifies and reduces everything to a second, to a beat. And Nixon was probably the first great tragedy of that medium, in terms of our deciding about somebody in a split second. And now, of course, we do it all the time about absolutely everybody.
And that's because the reason given for his losing to JFK, although there may have been other reasons, was that he looked so terrible in the first televised debates.
Yeah, and he doesn't, really. If you look at them again, JFK looks better. And, you know, the story...
Well, he was a handsome man.
He was, but the story is that people who listened to it on the radio believed that Nixon won. But people who saw it were affected by JFK's good looks and Nixon's sweaty upper lip and his not incredibly handsome face.
Didn't you originate this role in the London production the Dunmar?
Yes.
Are the British as familiar with this story as Americans are?
No, not as much. Certainly the interest there, all the pre-interest in the play was in the character of David Frost, because David is there, he lives in England, he's been a fixture there for 45 or, I guess, going on 50 years now. And when we came here, it switched because we're, this country, of course, is so familiar with Richard Nixon.
So people there are more attuned to the nuances of Michael Sheen's portrayal of David Frost.
They were very attuned to the sound of him the moment Michael comes on in
which
London.
Which he does brilliantly.
Yeah, absolutely. The minute he appeared in London, of course, there were great gales of laughter when he opened his mouth. And here, Nixon's appearance gets a rumble from people, and then I spend the first 5 or 10 minutes of the play making sure the audience understands this isn't going to be a caricature and it isn't going to be something to laugh at unnecessarily or inappropriately. Eventually you find out that Nixon is funny as well.
Because he was a witty man in his own way. Yeah. But that's what happened with me, I think, for the first 3 or 4 minutes. It was...
The visual.
I had to adjust, and then you became Richard Nixon. I didn't think twice about it from then on. In the case of Michael Sheen, he's making a kind of a career of this because he was Tony Blair in The Queen, and I was wondering whether he has to resign now because Blair is going.
I'm sure there'll be another. I'm sure that Peter Morgan is going to write that part of Blair's life, and there'll be a trilogy, and Michael will finish out the trilogy.
So since American audiences responded differently than the British audiences, has that changed the feeling of the play to some degree? Because
Yes. Because
the audience is always another character in every play.
Well, for me, always in everything I do, the audience is the last piece of the puzzle. I've never understood actors who say, I act for myself. I'm up there for my own sake. I'm up there for the audience's sake, and I want them to have a stirring, emotional, fascinating, angering, sad, funny, whatever I can stir in an audience, I'm willing to stir. And in this particular play, and because Nixon is such a familiar character, and because we try very much to bring full dimension to him so that he isn't just a crook and he isn't just a drunk, but he's a lonely, isolated, terribly paranoid, frightened, angry, full of bile person.
But also very smart, very clever,
yes,
wily.
And all the other things, too. His brain is so fervid and furtive, both things at the same time, that I think the audience is wrapped up in him in ways we didn't have in London. And what's really remarkable is the quality of the silence in the last 20 minutes. There's this wonderful phone call that Nixon makes late at night, drunk. And from that
this
moment
is totally imagined.
Yeah, totally imagined.
But really very revealing.
Very apt, I think, in which he basically explains to Frost that they are the same kind of person, each at the bottom of the ladder, each trying very hard to get back up to the top. And from that moment on, the stakes are now so high that the quality of the silence in the audience from then until the curtain is really thrilling.
My guest is Frank Langella, who stars as Richard M. Nixon in Frost Nixon, which is at the Bernard B. Jacobs Theater at 242 West 45th Street. Is this a limited run, or is this going to go for a while?
No, it's limited. We go until August the 19th, and we begin the film August the 27th, very short break.
David Frost once said that it was impossible to really know the former president. Well, you had to try to figure it out, didn't you?
Yes.
Do you think that he was right? Obviously, it's impossible for me to know Frank Langella from just the conversations we've had on the air.
Well, you know, it's an interesting question because I was talking to someone 2 days ago about someone who had been treating me very badly at one point and who behaved in sort of childish, foolish way. And I was describing how angry I was and hurt by this person. And after I finished getting it all off my chest, this person said to me, well, I've always had found him to be nothing but sweet and kind and thoughtful and charming, the total opposite of my experience. And I was reminded again never to judge anybody by what anybody else says about them or even what you see on the screen of them, but to only judge them, if that's the word, by how they treat you, one-to-one. Had I been in a room with Richard Nixon, I probably would have found him keenly intelligent and probably charming because it's the job of presidents to be charming to visiting guests. That would be different than if I'd worked with them. I'd have another experience.
We have a clip of David Frost asking Richard Nixon about Kissinger's personality. And that's kind of interesting because there's a lot of psychology going on. Maybe we should listen to it.
And after you do, I'll tell you what Henry told me about Nixon.
You must have had disagreements, I suppose. What were the most important ones? I'm a fatalist, basically. Kissinger is more, despite his enormous intellectual capability, is one who is perhaps somewhat less fatalistic and or determinist in his views, more emotional, interestingly enough. Although I, too, have emotions. I tend to hide them, perhaps, more than he does, or to submerge them or suppress them. But be that as it may, we won't try to psychoanalyze each other at the moment.
Richard Nixon, Henry Kissinger. And so revealing, don't you think, even though he called himself guarded?
It's also revealing in how much of a politician is he. He says, although I have emotions, but I really don't. I show them, but I really don't. Henry's this, but he's really that. He just covers all of his bases, and that was a trait I really discovered in studying him. You know?
And you spoke to a lot of people to gain insight into him,
endless
including
amount.
Kissinger?
Including Henry. Henry was the least amount of time I spent because we just happened by great fortune to be dinner companions one night at a dinner party, a very small one. So he was to my left, and I was able to. And this was after the play had opened in London, and he asked me about it and asked me, how am I portrayed in the play? And I said, well, you're not in it as a character, but you are. And he asked me how I came to feel about Nixon. And I told him I had developed enormous compassion for him. And first of all, when you're playing a part, you cannot judge the person you're playing. You must love them. And I do. He's my guy. And Henry said, I felt that way too in the later years, and in my reflections I came to feel affection for him and great respect for the brain. And if I needed a lawyer, Dick Nixon would have been the man I would have chosen.
Although Nixon also talks about Kissinger lapping up celebrity and in those Frost interviews. And sometimes being indiscreet and making fun of him. But he understood because that was part of being a celebrity.
I think they recognized in each other, as actors do, the monster side. You know, great monsters recognize other great monsters. And the funniest thing that Henry ever said was, I think it was Barbara Walters who asked him, what is it like now that you're famous and now that you're Secretary of State? And he said, it's wonderful now, because now when I bore people, they think it's their fault.
Mm-hmm. You spoke to others who had been close to Nixon. Did they all find him interesting?
Everyone.
And they all felt compassion for him?
I don't know. I spoke to Frank Gannon for a very long time, who worked with the president.
He's a historian.
And Barbara Walters, who interviewed him, sent me all of the tapes. Mike Wallace gave me all of the stuff he had. But again, people like Barbara and Mike will get their impressions based on interviewing him. They will not have spent an evening with him. They will not have gotten to know him at home. They're certainly not going to feel about him the way his daughters do or his colleagues do. Frank Gannon was, I think, one of my richest sources because he spent so much time with Nixon. And I asked him to describe Nixon just as a man, not as a politician. What was his impressions of him walking into a room, sitting in a chair? How did he behave that way? And he did. He very openly described the human being to me. And I think probably the most telling research, that's the word telling, was going to his house where he was born and sitting in the little tiny house in Yorba Linda in his bedroom, which was smaller than this studio, with a peaked roof so that I couldn't stand up in it straight. Two single beds, four boys grew up there, two died. His parents' bedroom was not much larger than a large walk-in closet with a double bed in it. And all the simple artifacts around, the bucket for the water and the tiny little sink and kitchen and the few dishes, A man grew up in that kind of simple Sears house. They bought it from Sears and became president and married his childhood sweetheart.
You do a lot of research. There are actors who've told me I just read the text and find the character in the text. But you seem to go all the way. I wonder what happened when you were doing Dracula. I fear for your friends' necks.
Yes, it's true. There are 30 years ago, there were women, many, many women all over the country with two puncture wounds in
them. Some of them probably were offering the necks.
Best research I ever did. But I actually don't because, funnily enough, I really believe fact and reality stifles your imagination. But in this instance, in this character and in this man, I felt a tremendous obligation to do all of that. So I, once I let it all go and once I took off in a flight of fancy, because it is, after all, part fiction, this play, and it is an evocation of someone, it is not a historical document, I wanted to have a ground, a rooted ground feeling about, grounded feeling about him. I wanted to have certain senses of him, and then I let it all go and let my imagination take over.
So you got a sense of who he really was rather than worried about whether you were making the V for victory sign or
yeah.
doing any of the other things that people, that Herblock might have noticed when he was doing a political cartoon.
And I also don't care much in this particular instance because we're doing a play about the political elements or the facts of what actually happened. I care about bringing a human being to the stage that people will have some form of some strong reaction to in all ways.
My guest is Frank Langella, who, along with Michael Sheen, Stephen Kunkin, Corey Johnson, Shira Gregory, I'm going to leave out some of the people, but I have to mention Stephen Rowe, who does the most amazing Swifty Lazar.
Yes, he does.
They're all performing in Frost Nixon, now at the Bernard B. Jacobs Theater on West 45th Street. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. And we're back with Frank Langella, who is starring as Richard Nixon in Frost Nixon at the Bernard B. Jacobs Theater at 242 West 45th Street. You've played a fair number of men of power, powerful men. We saw you as William Paley in a wonderful recent film, Good Night and Good Luck. We've seen you as Nixon, Dracula. There have been others as well. Do they all have something in common? You were Perry White in Superman Returns.
In terms of my career, I suppose I've noticed that a number of times that I tend to be attracted to playing singular men, sometimes mysterious loners. When I look back at all the roles I played, many, many of them have been that. William Paley, the man in Dave, Bob Alexander, and certainly Richard Nixon, and Dracula, and a couple of parts I played on Broadway.
Is that because people see you in those roles and offer you those parts?
I think it's twofold. I think they see me in those roles, but also I think my tendency to want to play those men is because they're full of either immortal yearnings or huge, giant issues to do with failure, to do with somehow overcoming and somehow having supernatural powers. I'm attracted to characters. I was very attracted to a character like Dracula and to Nixon because they're terribly flawed and they're much more interesting to play than the average Joe.
But those others were extroverts. And
yeah.
Richard Nixon is the only extrovert introvert who ever became president of the United States.
And he is, in fact, very much the opposite of me in manner, demeanor. And, you know, I am rather extroverted. I'm Mediterranean. I'm Italian. So finding those qualities, which are, of course, all inside me, and using them in an outward way was fascinating for me.
Because I think part of the fun of acting must be just becoming somebody else and understanding who that person is, at least for that certain period that you're on the stage.
It's actually not a great role if you don't learn something profound from it. And I'm learning more and more about myself every day when I play Richard Nixon. All the great parts are parts that test you and your own sense of yourself, because we all walk around with these ridiculous, foolish notions of what and who we are. And when you're an actor and you're able to delve into someone else's psyche, you really do find that you're playing mostly your own, or your own take on it, so that you're calling upon the things in yourself. I had to reach down and find the very worst of my nature, all my paranoia, all my suspicion, all my competitiveness, all my anger, all my desire to do in my enemies. And Nixon is the poster boy for that.
So does this function as a kind of psychoanalysis? After the fact, you're just going to be one of the most wonderful people anybody could ever know?
No, I'll never be that. It's too late. But you can take it too far in terms of psychoanalysis. Once the play is over, the character stays where he belongs. But it is still a blessing, really, and a privilege to be an actor, because you can explore all of these things in a creative, artistic way. You can act in spite of your neurosis, not because of it.
You mentioned earlier Peter Morgan. This is his first play, but he's written quite a few screenplays, and two of his most recent ones were huge successes. The Last King of Scotland, in which Forrest Whitaker plays the flawed, crazy guy, and The Queen, in which any number of people are flawed in different ways. So he obviously likes this sort of story.
Yeah, I think Peter's very drawn, equally drawn to power, powerful figures, and conflict.
Part of the build-up to the TV shows that the play is about involves how both camps hope to make the most of the interviews. Frost and Nixon had an awful lot to lose in the process. How well-known was David Frost in the United States at the time? And why do you think that Nixon was willing to be interviewed by him and not anyone else?
He started out in a show called That Was the Week That Was, and I remember him as a very young man.
That was a kind of comedy show that commented on the news.
And then David is, if nothing else, a man who survives and a man who keeps going on in all sorts of ways. I think Nixon and his people looked upon David as, a softball, an easy, easy interview for which he would be paid a great deal of money, and a lightweight interviewer who would not get him on the important issues.
They saw him more as an entertainer than as a news junkie. Yeah. But he did something that was quite smart. He hired people who did know, and he went into training. Both Nixon and Frost went into training for this. It was almost like a heavyweight bout.
And I think it should be said, importantly, and I don't think it's said enough, how much James Reston plays in this. Jimmy Reston is the inspiration for this play, his book. About Nixon, which I think is coming out again, is fascinating and wonderful. And James Reston had a great deal to do with uncovering the material that enabled David to finally trap Nixon.
And that he is a major character in the play as well.
He's the narrator of the play.
We mentioned earlier that it was kind of a thriller, and I said it was also like a chess game. The director, Michael Grant, had said it's a thriller. Does a British director bring something to this that an American might not have because he has perspective?
I don't know. I don't, talent is talent. Doesn't matter if you're British or American. Certainly Michael did his homework and was aware of what the historical elements are, but a less gifted director might not have brought out the thriller aspects, the mise-en-scene, the use of cameras, music, and the visual, and Christopher Oram, who did the sets and the costumes, who's Michael's partner. They work beautifully together and create the whole arena in which Michael and I are able to perform these characters. I don't think it matters much whether they're British or American. Talent doesn't know about that.
In your research, did you learn much about how Nixon trained?
Yes. Oh, one of the greatest days of my life was sitting at Richard Nixon's desk at the library and having his staff bring me in his personal notes that he was making in preparation for the interviews. And there would be large packets of things from Gannon and Diane Sawyer and other people.
She was working for him at the time?
She was working for him. He called her the tall girl. He didn't know her. He didn't know her name for a year. He called her the tall girl. And these notes would say, Mr. President, we think Mr. Frost might ask this particular question. We suggest this particular answer. And Nixon memorized those things.
Do you think that there was something of an actor about Richard Nixon? As an actor, do you see an actor in him?
Look, they're all actors. Every single one of them is an actor. What this has taught me more than anything else is that a second before you point to someone on the radio, they assume a piece of personality that they want you to see and they want the audience to hear. And just a beat before any politician walks out in front of a camera, he unconsciously or consciously makes a decision to present something. If you look at that wonderful tape of Mr. Edwards, whom I admire, getting his hair in order, it's wonderful. Who of us doesn't do that? It isn't something he would prefer. I'm sure that nobody saw. But I've been around so many people in the wings, in functions, and I've watched them change their personality within a split second. I've watched standing in the dark, hearing their name said, and I've watched a whole physical thing change, because that's what public life is.
Well, we all present a persona.
And we present it privately
and
as
sometimes,
well.
And sometimes we're better at presenting a good persona than others.
You know the maxim about show business. The thing you have to be to succeed in show business is sincere. And once you learn to fake that, you're in.
At what point in your research were you willing to watch the actual Frost-Nixon interviews?
Oh, from the start. It was one of the first major thing I did was spend 10 hours at the Museum of Radio and Television, and a lovely woman there brought me, I don't know, it must have been 100 tapes. And I just got a big glass of orange, big bottle of orange juice, and I just kept putting the tapes in. I put my feet up. It was the very first day of research well over a year ago, and I was overwhelmed by it. I couldn't stop scribbling on a yellow legal pad. He does this with his hands. He's always mm-hmm. that with his mouth. He's always licking his lips. I mean, there was so much to absorb and so much to play and then a lot to dismiss.
But it's interesting watching them now. I think we read all sorts of things into his answers that we wouldn't have known then, because we have a fuller picture of what really happened.
Yeah, it's no secret that he brought himself down. He could have avoided this in a second. All he would have had to have done immediately was say, these people made a terrible, heinous mistake, and I'm flushing them all out and getting rid of them, and I will pay whatever fines are necessary, and life would have gone on. It's the cover-up that killed him, really, more than anything else.
We talked earlier about how audiences in England responded differently to audiences in this country. What about the people who knew Nixon? Have they come up to you and talked about what they saw in the play?
Tricia Cox's entire family came, her husband and children and various relatives, and they were very kind to me about it and very, very thankful that I tried to give them a dimensional man and not just a drunken crook. And lots of people.
But it would have been an ineffective play if
you'd
done that.
It would have been a bore to play as well, and it would have been a cliche. And then people on his staff have come back, a lovely woman who worked for him, whom he gave an ambassadorship to, and many people have come back and said, I don't know how you know this about him, but, and told me something that was reflected from my performance. It was just pure instinct on my part. I had no fact about it. He ultimately affected people. He's one of those people who you cannot be about. You know, you either are terribly, terribly passionate about him in fury and rage, or deeply, deeply moved by his vulnerability, his pain, his awkwardness, his sweaty hands, his looking down at his feet all the time, all those things. I think in a way, I don't think I've ever quite thought of it this way before, that he's a walking example of the worst in all of us. You know, oh God, I don't want anybody to see how unattractive I feel. I want that girl across the room to really like me, and I'm going to put my foot in my mouth. And it was just there all over him. You couldn't miss it.
It's interesting that when you're approaching a role that was totally invented, you can come up with all those things. You can look down at your shoes because you think that that would be more effective. In this case, you have somebody who's already given you a lot of that. So I suspect that your problem is what is deciding what to leave out rather than what to put in.
Well, actually, I would say it in a different way, which is at a certain point, once I'd absorbed what I felt was the verisimilitude of it, if that's the word, the real truth of him, so I wasn't going to, you know, suddenly give him curly hair or walk with a limp or something. All those things, of course, would be ridiculous. But once the reality of him got deeply inside me, I forgot that, and then I let myself explore in anybody I play what I believe are the most human characters, characteristics, and clearly those things must exist in me or I couldn't play them. This is true of every character I play that I draw on myself.
All actors do, don't they? Well, at least all good actors?
Some actors don't, actually. Some actors, I think, say, my character would. I never use those words. I think this character would. The character is you, no matter who you're playing. From the time I was a very young actor to now, I sort of know that it's got to be pieces of me.
Haven't you also signed to do the screen version of the play?
Yes.
With Ron Howard directing?
Yes, I have.
Now, I'm assuming that things will change. You've done other things on the stage and then the movie version, Dracula, for example.
Only that.
With Laurence Olivier.
I know, but I'm an extraordinarily lucky actor that I've actually created two roles on stage that I'm getting to do the film of. That so rarely happens.
Because usually you wind up doing the Broadway thing and you assume they're going to sign you, and then they sign somebody who they think is bankable.
Exactly. Let's hope they think I'm bankable.
Well, I can't imagine who they would have signed for this after what you've done on the stage. But have you seen the film script?
No, not yet. I will be seeing it shortly. That said, George Hamilton came to see the play the other day, and we were talking about the fact that he very much wanted to play Dracula after I left the show, and the producers weren't interested.
Oh, so he would have been fabulous.
Well, he went and wrote his own script called Love at First Bite, and it was a huge success, and it came out before us, and it killed our film because he spoofed it, and it was wonderful, and very, very clever of him.
Do you see yourself as more of a theater animal than a movie person?
No.
Because for a while, it looks like you dropped out of films. I don't know whether it's their choice or your choice.
No,
but you've been doing a lot of theater.
It's, you know, I get, I talk about people behaving in disingenuous ways. Whenever I hear an actor say, oh, I decided to move away from pictures for a while, I laugh. You don't move away from pictures. They move away from you. And when they move away from you, I am fortunate enough to have a theater career. And I've always worked on the stage. And certain years I find myself with an incredible amount of riches. As now, I have a beautiful film I made called Starting Out in the Evening, which was a great success at Sundance, which is opening across the country in November. And I'm about to start shooting another wonderful film while I'm doing this, and Frost Nixon. So I have three films. But there have been 5-6 year periods where I certainly didn't move away from the movies. They moved away from me. But there's so much else I'm able to do that I'm lucky.
You've already won 2 Tonys, and you've been nominated for this one. Do you have enough space on the mantle to accommodate all of those statues?
If I don't, I'll build a bigger mantle.
Because that is the ultimate, even though we say that those awards don't matter all that much, especially when we think somebody else is going to win it. When we get those accolades, it really does feel great, doesn't it?
The ultimate is the performance, really, and all the other, the accolades and the awards are the small little visual representations of it. But and again, I'm not being disingenuous at all. I think awards are wonderful thank yous, and I enjoy getting them. But really, the performance is what lives inside you all the time, and you have those few marvelous moments when you hear your name called. But as I said the last time I won a Tony, I know the moments will be over quite quickly and someone else will be getting one. But the performance goes on with you, stays with you.
Are there any roles that you played that you have particular fondness for, or are they all your children?
I have been, again, I'm a very fortunate actor. I've always managed to do what I wanted to do, particularly in the theater. And I have a whole wheelbarrow full of great parts that I remember, like The Father, the Strindberg play, and Bob Alexander in Dave, and Claire Quilty in Lolita, and Dracula, and my first role, a lizard, in my Broadway debut. I have had a wonderful, wonderful army of people I've been able to explore.
So you began with Albee. That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, my first job.
And now Frost Nixon. It's being performed at the Bernard B. Jacobs Theater, 242 West 45th Street. If you want to buy tickets, the number there is 212-239-6200. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Always a pleasure, Leonard. I'll come back anytime you have me.
Oh, thank you.
Bye.